welcome back to the Jane Q Public Podcast, a show that focuses attention on the intersection of technology, civics, and American culture. Today's guest is Rachel Heseltine, a longtime colleague and friend who, like many other amazing people, I was able to meet online. She's currently the VP of Consumer Growth at Trader Interactive and a frequent speaker, trainer, moderator at conferences around the world on a variety of online marketing topics. She's also a former improv sketch comedy performer and currently writes poetry as an outlet. So this should be a great conversation. I'm thrilled to have her on the show. Welcome, Rachel.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yay. And I'll add, since it's in case it's not self-evident, you have an accent. And it's always nice to have people with an accent on the podcast.
Yeah, well, actually, this Labor Day will be 30 years to the day since I came over to the US.
Wow. Do you regret it?
No.
Are you sure? No, we're happy to have you. But, you know, things are a little weird. Things are a little dicey in America these days.
They definitely can be from time to time, but things are cyclical. Things should get better.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Okay. I love that. I love optimistic people. All right. So let's kick off our conversation with a quick icebreaker question.
Sure.
Number one is, no, we don't need to. We only have one. So hold on.
I was going to say, if the question's no.
Let me explain. I've just reformatted my show. And so before I used to ask three questions, but I felt like that really, we spent a lot of time on the icebreakers. So I was trying to cut it down to one. But I mean, I can give you more than one, but I only have one. Is that okay?
You should go for it.
Okay. What's the last book that you read?
I actually just finished this morning rereading The Meaning of Life. Which is by The Meaning of Life, which is by Douglas Adams and John Lloyd.
Oh.
It is an alternative dictionary where they've taken funny sounding place names. Initially, the first edition was in the UK, but it's around the world. And they've come up with humorous definitions for those places.
Can you give me an example?
So the one for the town that was closest to where I grew up was Glossop. And their definition of a glossop is a rogue blob of food.
Okay. There are worse things, I guess, right?
Yes, yeah, indeed. And there are lots of rude ones in there as well.
Of course. Okay, in addition, okay, so I'm glad you even brought this up because I have a question for you based on the bio that you sent me. And I'm just going to read what it says because I don't really understand it. And then you can explain to me what the hell this means. Rachel is the Duchess of Simonskorg, Ladonia, and a dame of the Order of the Polar Cross of West Arctica, both micronations. What is going on here?
Well, so here's the funny thing. I actually just came back from MicroCon 2022, which was this weekend in Las Vegas.
Oh, I see.
And that was... Yeah, that was a meeting of micronations from around the world. So there are many, many different micronations that some of them are set up as art projects. Some of them are set up as vanity projects. Some of them are set up as they want to form a community and have a sense of community. So they all come together every other year. This was actually the 2021 edition that, because of COVID, was pushed out a year. But It's a great way for folks to meet and talk about different things that can impact micronations. So, for example, the Queen of Ladonia gave a presentation on Saturday about estate planning and succession planning for your micronation. As the founder of Ladonia unfortunately passed away last year in a car accident, Lars Vilks, who you may know for other reasons. He drew a picture of somebody in 2007, someone that you don't draw a picture of.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, but he had founded Ladonia in 1996 as an art project. And it, you know, there is a full constitution. It's a matriarchy.
Ooh.
So yeah, there's lots of these different micronations around. West Antarctica were the ones who actually organized this meeting in Las Vegas this last weekend. And the next one is going to be back on their two-year schedule in Peoria, Illinois next year, hosted by Ladonia.
How do you start a micronation? Can you just start? Can anyone make one? Could I make one?
I think you can. I think that there are websites out there that tell you what you need to do for legal protection and for putting together a constitution, if you want to go that way. I mean, one of the gentlemen that was there on Saturday was from a country called Zakistan. Shockingly, his first name was Zach. But he had purchased a piece of land out in the Utah desert, and he declared it to be Zakistan. And he's been going out. It's something like a 2-mile walk from the nearest road in the desert in Utah. But he builds art projects on it, and he has passports. And you know, he did mention that one of the sad things is that there are stateless people around the world who do try to connect with micronations, and you know, in the hopes that they can get a passport and become, you know, and actually have a state, a place to belong to.
Wow.
And obviously micronations are not recognized by the UN or anybody. So
well, yeah. What do they know? The UN knows nothing. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is, I love this. I love it so much. Actually, I'm going to have to give some serious thought, because I would love to start my own nation, except I think I want it to be a tyrannical dictatorship. I don't think I need a constitution at all.
I'm sure that some of the folks that were there are along those lines as well. And some of the folks that weren't there who have their own micronations are along that line.
Okay. Well, my big question is, does Facebook count as a micronation, or is it too big?
So there was actually a group there from, I think they were, I'm trying to remember the name. It's like Obstantium or something along those lines. Uh-huh. And basically their micronation was a rock, which they brought with them.
Wow.
So they carried their micronation with them.
This is amazing. It's like, yeah, it reminds me of the Israelites carrying the ark with them, right? And like, mm-hmm. they were the nation that wandered around for a long time.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is, you know what? We're not going to go further on this, because I could probably go on a very long tangent. I'm into this. Okay, but before we move on, how did you become a dame and a duchess? I mean, do you have to apply for that?
So I became a duchess probably about 4 years ago, uh-huh. 5 years. Well, my investiture was in Vegas in 2018 with a group of other digital marketers. The Queen of Ladonia has been Queen since 2011. She's been involved with it for much longer than that. But she's a digital marketer. In fact, until recently, she was working at ESPN. So she was a Disney Queen.
Oh,
what? But so I've known her since 2006, 2007, something along those lines. And, you know, she'd been talking about Ladonia with us, and basically at one event I said, okay, what do I need to do to become a duchess? And she said, just give me a phone and your credit card. So she signed me up. I think, I don't believe there's a, I don't remember if there is a fee to become a citizen, but to become a member of nobility, you know, there is a fee associated with that. So I did that. And a year later in 2018 in Vegas, we had a nobility ceremony for about 9 digital marketers. And then when I attended this conference, for attending the conference, as West Antarctica were hosting it, they handed out the Order of the Polar Cross to every attendee. So every attendee who was male became a knight. Every attendee who was female became a dame.
Wow. Why is this so fun? I don't know, but I really am into it. This is just, wow. Okay. Yeah,
that's... this was not where you thought this was going, was it?
No! I freaking love it. Like, this is the coolest thing. I find that anything that changes our expectations or definitions of things, especially things that we consider institutions or so, you know, hard to penetrate, like statehood, maybe, that anyone can do this is just both mind-boggling and delightful. And I'm here for it, 100%. I'm here for it.
Yeah, I was actually interviewed for a documentary on the first night.
Oh.
And they were asking me questions about it. And my response was, I'm here at this for the first time. I'm finding out. I'm trying to, you know exactly what this is and, you know, how it all comes together and what the differences are across these micronations and what folks do. So it was really fun and interesting.
Wow. All right. Well, that's awesome. And I will be catching up with you more on that later as I found my own nation, whatever. Mm-hmm. I need to give it some thought, but it'll probably involve a queue. Yeah, right on. Well, all right. Rachel.
Yes.
let's actually interview you now.
Okay.
So I know you through a group of marketing people.
Yes.
Who shall remain nameless, but you fuckers know who you are. And, and, you know, you've been at this for a long time. I mean, you're a VP, right? You taught at Georgetown, right? You taught marketing at Georgetown for a little while.
Yeah, I taught SEO and a little bit more broader digital marketing there for about 5 years as part of their continuing education program.
Nice, nice. Yeah. So, and you've been here, have you been doing marketing since you came to the US?
No. I'm actually a reformed programmer.
Oh.
In my past life, I was I went through a program to become a COBOL programmer and immediately became a Smalltalk developer.
Wow.
And then migrated over into Java until one day we'd taken the yellow pages. How modern is that? And we put them online a bunch of telcos. And we then found this analytics thing, put that on the site, and we looked at it and we're like, okay, it's a straight line. What do we do to make this move now? And the CEO said, well, I've heard about this thing called SEO. Does anybody want to look into this? I'm like, you know what? I've been doing programming for a while. Yeah, I'll do it. And then my career completely changed.
Wow. When was that about?
That was April 2005.
Oh, wow. So that's... it's quite a while. And I think that that's really interesting because in my experience in marketing and being partnered with a longtime IT guy, mm-hmm. I find it very rare that you see people go back and forth between those two different professions, right? Or like any tech person tends to look down their nose at marketing like we're a bunch of snake oil salesmen. And the marketing folks are always looking at the tech people like they're process-obsessed automatons.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, it's obviously, with me being in SEO at the time, I mean, a lot of people do tend to throw out the snake oil mention that. But when I was at AOL for 6.5 years, my SEO team there, I had two former librarians, two former developers, a couple of former sales folks, and one former pastry chef.
Amazing.
Just an eclectic mix of backgrounds. But the way that SEO and digital marketing works, to be able to get those different backgrounds, get those different perspectives, was invaluable. I mean, the former pastry chef was one of the best content people I've worked with.
Interesting. Why do you think that is?
Well, she knew how to bake a story. No.
Oh, my goodness.
She just was. I mean, she had a great eye for content and a great eye for making sure that we were telling the right story in the right way.
That's actually pretty cool. And I try to tell people, I started doing digital marketing before digital marketing was actually a thing, right? And you and I come up from the same kind of... We're about the same age. We're about the same kind of generational shift between the analog and the digital. And so we've kind of seen how that happened. But I'd love from your perspective, and especially since 2005, when you began in earnest working in digital marketing, you know, what your kind of high level description of the arc of change in the U.S. has been since that time, and if and how you think, you know, the digital space has influenced where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's been a great deal of change since 2005, and especially since 92 when I first came to the country. And yeah, I mean, especially over the last 2 years, we've seen digital marketing and the closeness and communities that we have making changes as to how folks interact and work with each other and play with each other online. Going back to 2005, the world itself has changed quite a bit. And I know that's not very descriptive.
No, but it's hard. It is hard, right?
Yeah. It's like- and for me, I mean, I mentioned before that I worked at AOL. I mean, working at AOL was a company where if you didn't like the direction things were going, give it 3 months and the entire strategy would change. Because that's how quickly the digital marketing space was moving and changing and how we had to adapt to keep on top of it. Right. I mean, if you think back to, 1996, the leading application that we were all using then was it Pointcast, which was all push technology. And it kind of failed because we didn't have the bandwidth to be able to get that push technology. Then we went over to, AOL and its forums, and people would gather over there, and then you had Friendster and the precursors to Facebook, and then once Facebook came out, and Twitter came out, and we will not talk about Google Plus because footnote, but those communities of pulling folks together definitely gave you the ability to connect with folks that you never would have connected with before, or to reconnect with folks. I mean, I just actually reconnected last week with my oldest friend, as in I've known her since 1975.
Oh my.
We spent 20 years where we didn't talk to each other, not because we didn't want to talk to each other, but just because our lives went in different directions. And I just reconnected with her last week, and it's just lovely to be able to do that. During COVID, I had a weekly Cards Against Humanity game online with friends in Edinburgh and Swansea and Sheffield. And it was just absolutely lovely to be able to have that closeness with them. And I think for my 50th last year, because as you mentioned, we're in that generation that people don't talk about, the one in between boomers and millennials. For my 50th, I think you were on my birthday stream last year. Yes.
I was. I attended your birthday. And
I would never have thought to have done that. I would, in a regular time outside of the pandemic, I would have gone out with like 3 or 4 friends for my birthday. But instead, I did a live stream with a comedian / musician from Iceland and invited friends from all around the world to join in and just enjoy the experience and enjoy my birthday. And that was just absolutely lovely to be able to do. And that's something that you definitely wouldn't have done years ago. There's been a lot of closeness with our community. Now, then there's the other side.
Yeah. Talk about the other side, Rachel.
Yeah, the other side where there is that complete lack of civility. There is that that hatred. There is that trolling that, I'm a member of some communities, and there are definitely folks that like to go out there and troll and show their disdain and hatred of those communities. And, we have each other within those communities to help each other out, but there are always people trying to put their foot on you and stop you from, continuing to live your life. I'm an admin in one group, which is a similarish group to the group you and I met in, except it's a meme group, but it's as irreverent as that group. And I'm an admin on it, and we are very, very close about who we let into that group. As of this morning, I think we're about 3,300 members, but we reject probably about 30% of the people who apply for that group. We go through, we look at their profiles, we make sure that they are not somebody who's going to be disruptive. And if somebody does slip through and is disruptive, they're kicked out.
Yeah. Man, a couple of things about this. One is I'm in the middle of reading this book that talks about the history of the internet, really just the last two decades. And there's a huge chunk in there about AOL because, you know, the kids today don't know, but AOL was the thing. Like, it was a massive cultural shift, right? Like, it changed.
AOL was the internet.
It was the internet, yeah. And one of the interesting things about that, the author points out, is that, you know, they were trying to sell product, right? They were trying to sell downloads. They were trying to sell whatever kinds of services and products. And what they realized is that people were actually way more interested in just talking to each other on their forums, right? And like, they weren't buying as much like stuff, but they were really invested in these ongoing conversations and relationships that they were building. And that was my experience too. I came into the internet through like mommy message boards. Mm-hmm. And that's like when the light bulb went off for me. It was like, oh, the internet isn't just this repository of information. It's actually a space where you can go and socialize with people.
Yeah. I mean, AOL is where I first jumped on the internet. I think in maybe 96. Pretty early on-ish for AOL. I think they had maybe like 1.5 to 2 million members at that point. But yeah, I mean, the forums were the thing. You know, you would log in hearing those noises and wait for the phone line to come on. And when you eventually got in and found out you'd got mail, you go and check out the forums and see what folks were talking about and folks who had similar interests to you and have those conversations in there. But yes, AOL eventually realized that they needed to pivot. They became more of a owned and operated content site, away from being a portal. I actually joined them in 2009, 6 months before the split from Time Warner. So I wasn't there when everybody made their money. But I was there for the divorce and the split and to help them to grow those owned and operated content sites, which eventually culminated in us purchasing HuffPost in 2011. And everything changed and just being able to work with those teams. And that was a team that had a great deal of community. I think at the height they were getting something along the lines of 3 million comments a month across the HuffPost properties. Yeah.
I remember that was the big draw for Huffington Post, especially in the beginning, was just the comment sections. Like, that was where people were going to do a lot of what you see now on Twitter.
Yeah. And then, of course, some executive made the decision, well, we can reduce costs and get rid of the content moderation team, the comment moderation team, and just use Facebook as our commenting system. So that entire team went away. And yeah.
Well, that's the next piece of what I was going to say originally was what's so interesting to me is having come up out of the forum culture, it was sort of like inherent to anyone that was there, the need for moderation. Mm-hmm. And the need to invest enormous amounts of time and energy into maintaining and cultivating community, right? And it was actually an amazing training ground because you really had to think through. In some ways, it's like building a micronation, mm-hmm. right? Like you have to think about it as if it were a space that you're the mayor of this space or you're the governor of this space and all these people are going to have conflict and they're going to come to you and you have to be the one to, if it's your board, you're the one that has to be clear. And, you know, if you make stupid choices or if you show favoritism, it's going to destroy your community. So there's all this stuff that really goes into consciously maintaining community online. And it just seems wild to me that at some point, everyone decided that wasn't that important.
Yeah. Right? By the way, I like the way you've tied this back into the micronations at the beginning.
No, it reminds me of it, right?
Absolutely.
It's very much like that. Yeah. I think it's fascinating, actually, because what is a nation or what is a community, you know, and that's something that I talk to people a lot about in my work is how are we defining these things? What are you putting in place so that people can build relationships? Because we evolved as human beings to be in communities and to have norms and to have understanding between one another of, you know, this is our social contract. And so if you're going to convene a group of people, and some of these, I mean, friend, I have seen Facebook groups with like thousands and thousands of people with no moderation, and it is a shit show. Oh, and I'm like, whose idea was this? Mm-hmm. This is a terrible idea. This is not a community.
Oh, absolutely. And you need that moderation. You need to, it gets, again, very similar to the micronations. You need to have rules. Uh-huh. You need to have somebody who is there to enforce those rules. Because without rules and order, there's chaos.
Absolutely. And there's an expectation that people have. And, you know, I guess I'm a little more patient with folks that are just like building their own community because, and learning along the way. But what I find mind-boggling is that there are, you know, there's companies, multinational organizations, right? Mm-hmm. There's even local government is holding space online and not allotting resources to maintaining that community. And to me, that's the mind-boggling piece because that's going to actually impact you in, and this is not like some theoretical exercise, right? It's going to impact community offline too, if it's not cared for properly. And so do you think that ultimately that's just a matter of penny pinching? I mean, or why?
It still may be that folks don't understand. They may think it's the whole Field of Dreams thing. If you build it, they will come.
Yeah. But, they'll come and then they'll burn it down.
Well, either that or it will just atrophy.
Yes, that's right. That's the other extreme.
Because if you're not helping it and maintaining it and growing it, that's the other possibility.
Yeah.
Or somebody else just takes it over and molds it into their image.
Exactly. Oh, I've seen a couple of good coups in my time.
Oh, yeah.
On forum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, that's, it's so interesting because it just seems to me that more and more our definitions of community and of nations and of organizations are going to, it's going to become different. And we're using online spaces in some cases exclusively for community and in some cases to build a bridge. And, I have a lot of energy invested into trying to help people do that better. But I think one of the things that's so frustrating for me is that it seems like a really hard sell. And I'm not sure why that is. I'm just not sure.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think that these days, people who are in positions of power know enough now that social is not just let the neighbor's kid work on it or let the intern work on it. That it is something that actually needs to be cultivated. You know, in some cases, that's a matter of let's show the ROI. Let's show what we get out of this. Are we trying to build a brand? Are we trying to build a community? Are we trying to build engagement? And there should be that level out there of people displaying that data, sharing that data, so that folks who are in those positions of power do understand that. And I think in a lot of cases, a lot of places I've worked at over the last, 10 years, that's been understood. Mm-hmm. But I think there are still probably some holdouts who just think it is, it's not necessarily worthwhile to them because they don't see that immediate investment. And yeah, we on the SEO side, we used to get that as well because people would say, well, SEO takes 3 to 6 months for it to work. No, we'll do something else now then. And then we'll come back to it in 3 to 6 months. But then you'd say, no, if we come back to it in 3 to 6 months, then it's going to take 3 to 6 months to do it again for it to actually work. So perceptions are challengingly challenging.
Well, and I think, too, this is the lament of Generation X is I do feel like we end up being in a translator position a lot of times, where we're trying to make appeals to people that are both older than us and younger than us, and explain why certain things need to happen in a certain way and what the limitations are, and like just explaining things that I feel should be self-evident. And I don't just mean to older people. I also mean to younger people, right? So on one hand, you know, you have to explain to older people what the, or, you know, and I'm not trying to make this an age thing. I'm talking about a generational thing. If you are born into, or you are in, you know, indoctrinated from an early age into, you know, a digital mindset, you're just going to think and solve problems differently. And so, you know, we have the sort of advantage of coming from a almost completely analog life and then switching over midlife, you know, in the middle of our lives. And it just seems really like I spend a lot of time explaining to some people why technology is and how it got here and, you know, what, how to use it. And then on the other hand, I feel like I spend a lot of time trying to explain to people how to actually treat humans and be professional and, you know, like actually get shit done instead of just, you know, like things that I think should be self-evident about being an adult professional, right?
Yeah.
Or just a good person. And so basically the bottom line is everyone sucks but us.
Which is why they all ignore us.
So true. They're jealous, Rachel. No, but it is. It's, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I find it incredibly frustrating because it just seems like we have these large populations, subpopulations that are speaking completely different languages and both resent it when we try to explain to them.
To an extent, yes. I agree with you on that. I mean, I've definitely had situations where I have been in rooms with folks who are younger than me saying, we should be doing this, we should try this, we should try that. And I'm like, okay, let's hold down here. We tried that 3 years ago. It didn't work. Here's why it didn't work. But if we can come up with a different way of doing it, maybe it will work. But let, you know, so there's a lot of explaining things as to why they are the way they are, how they got to that stage, is what you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
And yeah, it can sometimes be fun. And there's also then, and again, not to make it generational, but for some of the more mature folks, a little bit of knowledge can be a very dangerous thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And look, I mean, I've made a pretty good living for a long time in that role. Mm-hmm. So I'm not bitching too much about it. I'm just saying, you know, we're shooting ourselves in the foot in a lot of ways because we're not listening to one another and we're not taking the best from both sides of the, or both ends of the, or any group that has something to contribute, right? Like there's a whole movement of, you know, DEI and, you know, people out there who have taken on the banner of racial justice in every aspect, including business, right? In every aspect of society. And they're pushing for change here and there. And we need to listen to those groups of people, right? We need to listen to people who have collective consciousness around some of the big challenges. And
I will say, it's funny that you mentioned that because I'm in the office today and I've had to put a sign up on the door that obviously I'm recording in here. Because our DEI council is here for a full day task force meeting to talk through their strategy for DEI for the rest of the year. So that is something that they take very seriously here. We take very seriously here at Trader Interactive.
That's fantastic. And I think, look, I've seen a huge shift. I mean, I do. Like, I know I sympathize with my millennial and Gen Z friends and family who are frustrated by how slow progress seems to go. And at the same time, I see how much has changed in my lifetime. And I know that it's I know that we're making progress. I do. Not to say that it's a set it and forget it thing. We're constantly going to have to be on it. It's going to constantly require tending and vigilance. But I also don't feel the despair that I see from a lot of people, because I have actually seen the needle move. That's the advantage to getting older, I guess.
Yeah. There is definitely, again, without generalizing too much, I mean, I'm going to just now say that an entire generation, there does seem to be like a swathe of folks in a certain age range who lack patience. They want that immediacy. And that's, you know, we see these studies all the time about short attention spans.
Yeah.
They want things right now. They want things, they can't wait. They don't necessarily have all the facts, but they want everything that they want now. And there has to be an understanding that there are processes, there are procedures. Things can take time to happen. Mm-hmm. Yes, we would all love for rights for LGBTQ across the country to be perfect. We'd love for women's rights to be perfect across the country. That would be lovely to have that happen tomorrow, you know. But you elect somebody into office who promises they're going to move the needle on things. That doesn't mean that you're going to get everything immediately. There are processes, there are procedures, and there are stumbling blocks. Sometimes it does take, you know, those two steps back before you can make those three forwards. And, you know, sometimes those two step backs are what's needed to be able to energize folks to move in the right direction, which is what I'm really hoping with the things that have been happening over the last few months are going to help things to move back forwards in the right direction,
yeah,
rather than back to, you know, the 1950s / Stone Age.
I go back and forth in my head about this a lot. You know, it's mm-hmm. easy to point all of this out. But on the other hand, isn't that the function of youth, is to push and to, you know, like when I was younger, I was extremely obnoxious about things, right? And, but on the other hand, I know from my own experience that people who have authority, people who have power, don't want to change, especially if things are working well for them, and they need to feel uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think a lot of what I think it's almost like a natural sort of phenomenon that when you get to a certain age as a young adult and you're, you know, you've got all this power and dynamic energy and you have a really strong vision about what's gone wrong and what you want to see in the world. And then you spend a good decade and a half like mm-hmm. pushing for that until you get to your 30s, and then you become disillusioned, right? and then you have to start like making or even 40s, because I didn't start doing this till I was in my 40s, making like concessions yeah. within yourself, right? And making compromises and realizing that mm-hmm. the work is not going to get done in your lifetime, and that's okay, because part of your job as a grown-up is then to help the next generation grow up and push.
Yeah, although you can also then selectively pick the battles. You can pick the things mm-hmm. that you can actually make change with and try to help those move forwards. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if you look at Gen Z, all right, Gen Z, they are much more accepting of LGBTQ,
yeah, for sure,
folks. I mean, my daughter has grown up with trans friends,
yeah,
and so to her, it's nothing. It's just, you know, not even batting an eyelid.
Yeah, how old is she?
Where she will be 21 in September.
Ah, okay, yeah, mine are 19, and they're very similar.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are those changes that are going to naturally happen over time, but for those of us who are, you know, in our 50s or older, we don't have that much time left. You know, maybe we've got 30, 40 years if we're lucky, or in some cases unlucky. But, you know, so for us to make those changes, we have to, I don't want to say we have to make the change, we be the change we want to make, but we have to help to push those forwards.
Yeah.
And it becomes very difficult when, and this falls back into marketing, when those folks who want to oppress and suppress are able to use marketing and leverage it to the point where they can make other issues the forefront so they can come in and do that suppression of those issues. I mean, I live in Virginia, mm-hmm. and our current governor pushed on CRT as the big issue. And that's how he was elected, because we had pretty much been a blue state. We are now a red state because of that. And while he is refusing to make comments about whether he thinks that LGBTQ, you know, gay marriages should be protected, he's basically saying, well, you know, at the moment they are protected by federal law. But he's not stating that he will step in and stop that should the Supreme Court make a change to that, which is very scary for a lot of my friends who are in gay marriages or who are contemplating that.
Right.
You know, are they going to be accepted? Are they, you know, are they going to have to move to a state that has those laws that protect them? Which is very sad in a lot of cases, because if, you know, if you enjoy your area and you enjoy your local community,
yeah,
you're going to have to give that local community up to go somewhere where you're safe.
Do you think that it's part of, do you think that that is the idea, is to get people uncomfortable enough that they move away so that the powers that be in these different areas can consolidate?
That may be some of it, but also think about those folks who can't.
No, well, of course. Yeah,
Those folks that are below the safety net, they don't have the ability to move out of the area. They don't have the ability to fight necessarily.
Yeah.
They're just surviving and existing. And that's a very sad, very scary thing. I don't know if you saw the email that the folks from Cards Against Humanity sent out yesterday.
I didn't.
They had done a survey about abortion rights in red states, where they had asked folks in those red states what they knew. And as you might expect, a lot of folks in those states didn't know that abortion rights had changed.
Mm.
They didn't know what the actual laws were. Some of them were, and this just is so, because the whole thing is that they're saying that they're doing this because they're pro-life and they want to respect the life of the child. One of the numbers that stuck in my head was that 7% of the people they asked said that if a mother had an abortion, she should be executed.
Oh, my God.
So how is that a pro-life stance? I don't understand that, but...
I mean, I think the issue is that there is no logic to it, right? That's the thing. And there doesn't need to be, because if you believe something, you know, then you don't need to find ways to justify it. You don't need to explain it, and it doesn't need to make sense to anyone else. And I think that's how we operate on a lot of things. I think the human race operates that way, but I think it's become weaponized. And I think the information ecosystem has become weaponized to feed into that and to bolster these ideologies that aren't actually based in anything real or reasonable. They're just these kind of scary notions that people have. And, you know, you've got a nation of people who are basically working all the time and very tired, mm-hmm. and don't have a lot of energy to look into any of these things and don't want to feel uncomfortable. And so they're just going to go along with whatever sounds good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, or whatever they're told. You know, if you see something long enough, you're going to believe it. I think there was a study that, I forget who was it was that did this, but they took a group of conservative Fox News viewers and had them watch CNN for a month. And they asked them the same questions at the beginning and the end. And their views had definitely moved.
Hmm.
Because it's what you hear and it's what you see and it's what solidifies in your mind. So, you know, I go back to the UK and my parents buy Rupert Murdoch's newspaper alleged newspaper. And I look at that with outside eyes now. Mm-hmm. And you can see how that editorial staff are twisting mm-hmm. the news to their viewpoint.
Right, right.
And it's really sad. And it's disgusting, but it's, I mean, for one, it's how he's built his empire across the world. Mm-hmm. And it's how he's elected prime ministers and presidents around the world.
You know, I was talking to a journalist in a couple episodes back, and he and I were talking about, you know, on one hand, digital media has kind of broken down a whole bunch of barriers, and it's made it possible for people to challenge the status quo, to challenge power. And I'm talking mm-hmm. about like even journalists themselves within their own newsrooms and within their organizations, you know, being able to push back and on just sort of like this white male managerial status quo that's been for so long. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question I have for you is, yeah, that's all great. And on the other hand, we see that at the same time that the democratization of media has given access to more people, it's given access to more people. And some of those people mm-hmm. are nefarious and are attempting to use media in a way that is not for the greater good. And mm-hmm. on top of all of that, we have a public that has no real training or understanding about how information professionally, if you are in communications or a journalist, how that process works so that they can ask the right questions about, you know, where did this come from? How was this produced? Mm-hmm. How do we solve multiple things are going to have to happen, but like, where is the easiest entry point here where we can go in and be like, y'all, this is destructive. It is destructive. The way that things are happening right now is destructive, because what it's mm-hmm. doing is it's allowing everyone to shop for relative truth. Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean this across the board. Right. I understand that the political right in America is propagandized and, you know, they have a very specific machine at work. And I think that that happens also on the political left. And I think that every person in America, like the vast majority of us, are still, you know, so overwhelmed with the amount of information that's blasted at our eyeballs all damn day, that nobody is thinking through any of this a handful of people are, but they're usually like in ivory tower somewhere are thinking this through. But for the most part, like we're just scrolling and consuming, and little bit over little bit, we're just isolating things that we agree with and pushing away things that we disagree with. And hey, that's great. That's your prerogative. But also, you can't trust, like, confirmation bias. It's not a trustworthy method for finding out what's true. I'm sorry, it's not.
Yeah, so I think a couple of things in there. One is, yeah, most people are in their own echo chambers. Mm-hmm. They are in their communities, are folks who have same or similar beliefs to them. And if they don't, they get blocked mm-hmm. or removed from those communities, which then just reinforces what they've been hearing in the first place.
Right.
But I did want to go back to your comments about the fact that, you know, there are more citizen journalists these days, that there are potentially more voices or easier ways to get out. I think one of the biggest issues is that we don't have as many independent newspapers or news sites or television stations anymore. That they're all conglomerate-y.
Right.
I'm sure you've seen those clips where it'll be from 15 different TV stations around the country, and they all say the exact same thing, the anchors, because that's what they've been told to say.
Yep.
That's what's come down from on high. So. And a lot of newsrooms, you've seen reductions in staff, or you've seen the older experienced staff who do know how to go out and do the correct sourcing for a story and the correct validation for the story get pushed out in favor of folks who are just writing listicles or updating older stories or just in some cases making stuff up. It's challenging, and I don't know that, you know, I think the only answer I can give you is 42. I don't think I can give you a definitive answer as to how we're going to fix the world. It's a challenge, and again, it comes back to what you were saying earlier, that those in power are happy with the status quo,
right?
Because
right.
it got them to where they are in power.
Right.
It's only when you have people who are willing to make that revolutionary change that you see those shifts. And even then, there is a lot of fight back on that revolutionary change.
Yeah,
and yeah, I mean, folks who are out there, everyday folks who are, like, I'm thinking about the Affordable Care Act right now.
Yeah.
You know, that's something, I grew up in a country where I had a single payer health service. We had the National Health Service. Mm-hmm. And there are things right with it. There are things wrong with it. But I miss my NHS. Here I have a health service that is not great. It's not the best.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it is where it is. But the Affordable Care Act would have helped with that. And yeah, it's out there and it just never got pushed to where it was because it got trodden on and pushed down. And now it's almost kind of forgotten about. Mm-hmm. And we get other legislation that comes through, you know, about various things, whether it's LGBTQ, whether it's about abortion or whatever, and they get pushed back, they get watered down, they get pushed off. And again, a lot of that comes about because of this misinformation that's out there. You know, they have this narrative, they find a narrative that works for them,
right.
that is believable, and they push that narrative. And that narrative is what becomes the prevailing sentiment. Then folks either become apathetic towards it, or they move on to whatever the new sentiment du jour is, or the new topic du jour.
Yeah.
And things get forgotten about,
yeah,
left behind. I think it was Harold Wilson that said, a week is a long time in politics. It's true.
Yeah.
It is. And for the digital world we have now, a week is a heck of a long time.
Well, and I feel like 24 hours is a long time in journalism. So,
yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Like, it's just, it never ends. And I feel like media literacy is thrown around a lot. People talk about it a lot. But I don't feel like that even covers it. I think there's an entirely different way of thinking. It's almost like, you know, like checkers versus chess.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a sophisticated grasp, in this country at least, on how information is used and the power of mass communications, you know, just as a, you know, like a theory, and what it looks like when it's applied. We don't understand what propaganda is. We don't understand the difference between editorial and investigative journalism. Like, we are just very bad at all of this. And part of that is because it's just not taught to us, but we can't afford to not be good at it anymore. We just can't. And if you go, yeah. like, I know there are people in other countries where propaganda, like, they're much more skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
People that I've talked to from other parts of the world are much more skeptical. And I feel like we have this naivete and we're holding on to it, which is what's even worse. Because every time you bring it up and every time you try and start to broach the subject of, we should be questioning all these things, and, you know, this may not actually be what it seems, people close down and they turn off and they go back to whatever it is they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, there are many instances of things like that happening. It falls into the fact that you've got that confirmation bias. So the only skepticism in those cases you're going to have is about what the other people are saying. The right. thing that doesn't right. agree with your viewpoint,
right.
then you're going to be skeptical because you've been told to be skeptical about that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to investigate and follow up. Because again, yeah, people don't have time. People, you know, there's so much data coming in from so many different sources, but it's what is the actual data and what is just that propaganda?
Yeah.
And propaganda is a very, very powerful tool.
Incredibly. We know, we're in marketing. We know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a fine line. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. And I know that these aren't easy questions and they're not really subject to easy answers, but I love being able to talk to somebody with knowledge and experience about them, because, you know, my hope is that if people listen to my podcast, that they're also interested in these kinds of things, that they're concerned about the way that we are building out our world. And in 200 years, we might all be our own micronations. Who the hell knows? Who knows what's going to happen? But as long as I'm here, I think there's going to be a lot of fascinating and interesting possibilities. And my only wish for us is that we're able to make informed choices, right? Because I feel like a lot of the choices were not actually that got us to this point. And we've only been at this for a short period in the eternal stream of things, right? But a lot of the choices that we've made were not actually choices. We just went along. We've adopted so much of this technology and become so dependent on it in a very short period of time. And instead of looking at the potential, what does healthy digital space look like and how do we build that for ourselves? We seem to be preferring to stay in toxic environments and argue about what's not getting done. And, you know, like, I would just like to see us switch gears a little bit and be a little more proactive and really start thinking and building something better. Because in the last 15 years that we've been carrying out the democracy of this country on Twitter, it's not getting any better. And I don't think it will.
No, not at all. But if you don't mind, I'm going to tell you a little personal story that happened to me a couple of weeks ago. So I went to a wedding in Philadelphia, and it was a friend's wedding. My best friend and his wife flew over from Wales. Lovely time, lovely wedding. Afterwards, we went to a friend of theirs who held the after party for the wedding. It was lovely, big house, lovely, wonderful time. Ended up drinking way too much. That's what you do. It's a wedding. It's a celebration. It was an Irish-Italian wedding, so lots of bruschetta, lots of booze. So the next day, they invited us back again for breakfast. We went and had breakfast. Then we had sushi. Then we had tacos. It was an all-day thing again with, again, a lot of food, a lot of good talk. But the gentleman whose house we were at, he was on the right side of the political spectrum. And he, you know, he was making some of his points made in conversations, and it was his house, rather than engaging on something that I disagreed with, I would either listen or I would just step out. One of those moments when I stepped out, he was in there with my best friend, and he turned to my best friend and said, "I'm really glad that Rachel came to this, because she has completely changed my perspective on trans people. I would never have thought to engage with somebody who was trans and just listen to them and talk to them. Please forgive me for misgendering her when I have done."
Right.
To be absolutely fair, every time he misgendered me, he immediately corrected himself. So that was absolutely lovely. And
good.
That was just so lovely to hear from him, you know, that we could have those differences, but he was willing to change his viewpoint by actually sitting down and talking to me. And that's, I think what's wrong in a lot of these cases is that folks don't sit down, don't talk to people. They just believe what they're told about folks.
Right.
You know, they believe that trans people are evil, that gay people are going to try and convert their children, rather than actually sitting down and talking to them, getting to know them and realizing that we're all human beings, just like them. We're all humans. So let's find that common ground. Let's find out, you know, how we can change those perspectives, how we can make them realize that that garbage they're listening to, they're hearing about the other side is exactly that. It's propaganda.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story. And it's something Rachel, that I believe in so deeply, which is the power of bringing people together and letting them experience one another in a safe and comfortable environment. And almost inevitably, it's almost impossible for people to walk away. I mean, you look at that situation that you were in, you were at a home, at his home, you were in his home court, you were, you know, partying, basically having fun, and at the same time, you know, engaging in conversations, and you weren't triggered and freak out and, you know, you didn't start yelling at him for his right-wing views. You just let it lay and were, you know, represented yourself for who you are. And to me, that is social. What that environment is social. What you see on social media is antisocial. It's not creating space for vulnerability. It's not creating space for honest and authentic engagement, or at least not in, you know, wide open public and porous forums like Twitter. And, or, you know, very rarely is it changing people that are that different. And so for me, if we're going to use, you know, the internet for like all this good shit, world peace and, you know, happiness and whatever, then we really need to start thinking about how to structure it better. Because there is no substitute for getting people together and giving them an opportunity to truly socialize, even across differences. And I think that's what's missing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. You know, when you have those open public forums, I mean, to paraphrase you, it's a shit show. But you know, at least with things like Facebook, where you can have those private communities. I mean, one of the groups I'm in, I'm actually an admin on as well, is Nikki Fiasno's transgender support group. And that is a support group for transgender folks who are maybe beginning their transition or have questions about their transition. And we're there just to support each other. You know, even if it's just something along the lines of saying someone looks pretty in their picture when they're having dysphoria, or whether it's giving advice on how to negotiate a particular step, whether it's, you know, coming out to your parents or whether it's doing legal paperwork.
Yeah.
Just helping folks get to where they need to get to in an environment that is nurturing and supportive, which unfortunately the overall open social network is not.
Right. That's right. That's right. And I think that is a beautiful example of, it's not what you're using, it's how you're using it, right? Yeah. Because, you know, people like to bag on Facebook. And look, I'm not here to defend Facebook, but also I have had some amazing experiences using Facebook, and it's because of how I use it, right? And I guess the same thing can be said about Twitter, but I think when we're talking about actually building community that is meaningful and that gives people opportunities for growth, you're not going to be able to do that without having some kind of social contract in place. And it's impossible to do that on a forum like Twitter, or appears to be, right? Like, I haven't seen it happen. So to me, like, that's a perfect example. And, you know, like, the technology is going to change. We came up from the forum world, right? And now we're on these social platforms, and there will be other iterations of where people convene online. But overall, we're dealing with people, right? And so however we use these technologies, they must jive with like what it means to be human. And I just don't, like I said, because we haven't gone about this thoughtfully, I don't see a lot of success that way. But the people who have done it thoughtfully have done amazing things online.
Yeah. I mean, people are amazing, wonderful, hateful, horrid things. Uh-huh. but they're people.
Yeah.
That's what they are. They're products of their life.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's how we interact with each other. It's how we work with each other. It's there is the capacity, the capability for us to have these groups. I mean, again, you and I met in a Facebook group.
It's true. It's true.
Whereas the reason I got into that group was I met Amy years ago, our mutual friend Amy, who we hired to help us at AOL because she was in the dig community back in the day.
That's right.
So she was helping to dig our posts at AOL. It's from there that I've got into these other communities, mm-hmm. you know, meeting you and meeting the other folks in there through things that have changed in my life. Obviously, as a transgender person, I'm now in different communities and have different perspectives as I'm introduced to those different communities and those different people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just have to say, you know, and I don't want to make this about being trans because mm-hmm. I think that you have so much to offer the world and I'm sure you speak on it all the time. And I also don't want, I mean, I want you to know that I value you as a guest above and beyond just your identity, which is beautiful and wonderful. But I looked at you as such an incredible example of grace and you're just exemplary of what it looks like for a member of a marginalized community to conduct themselves online despite what it's like online, right?
Yeah.
Which is not to say that you are kumbaya, you know, hippy dippy, whatever. Mm-hmm. What it does say is that you're not a fool, that you understand how people operate, that you understand your own limits and what's needed to be able to represent yourself and to be able to protect yourself. And you do it in a way that's true to who you are and what you believe is right. Right. And I do admire that so much about you as a member of the trans community.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, it's, I don't want to cry now, but it has been very interesting going from cis white het guy and in those groups to where I am now. You know, it's been, I mean, the word transition is not really overused. There have been so many transitions and so many steps along the way and so much change, but I'm still the same person. I present differently. I have clothes that have fewer pockets. when I went to the conference last weekend, I have been to Vegas many times, but I was seeing things through new eyes.
Yeah.
The same eyes, but new eyes. I was happier with myself and who I am than I've ever been. And that's true of me now. I mean, I am who I was meant to be now.
Yes. And you know how I know that is that it doesn't feel strange to talk to. Like, I just in my mind, it's like, oh, like there was no transition period there for my mind. Like I was like, oh, okay, that's what that is now.
Yeah.
And it's Rachel and it's not a problem.
Yeah.
Like it's just, but I think part of it is because you feel so much more comfortable in your skin now that it just makes it like the other person didn't even really, wasn't there. Like, or they were, but they were just somebody I used to know and now I don't. Now I know you.
I used to be a software developer, then I became a marketer. I used to be someone else, and now I'm Rachel. It's the same thing. It's the evolution of my life.
But you still like Doctor Who, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I mean, the Doctor is a trans icon.
Hallelujah. That is awesome.
Yeah, and talking of communities, I mean, that's been an interesting community since Jodie became the Doctor.
Yeah. You know, I'm not active in any Doctor Who fandom stuff, but, you know, I've seen some chatter online around it, obviously.
Well, I mean, immediately on Amazon, the series was rated exceptionally poor before it aired.
My God.
Because the, you know, those poor little basement dwellers couldn't handle it.
Well, and to me, that's the most bizarre thing is you take something so of the realm of imagination,
mm-hmm.
where literally anything is possible in a show like Doctor Who, and then people lose their minds when Doctor Who is played by a woman. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Like, if anyone could be anything, it would be Doctor Who.
Well, and the funny thing is, I mean, they had laid this out for several years beforehand. Uh-huh. You know, the master became Missy, played by the wonderful Michelle Gomez.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And there was a mention at one point of another Time Lord called the Corsair being a woman at one point. So it's not like it was something that was just jumped on them. But it's going to be very interesting when we get to, without spoilers, when we get to Shuti Gatwa as the new Doctor, when we have the first Black Doctor. Although, actually, he is not the first Black Doctor, we had the before Doctor, who was a Black woman. So, played by Jo Martin.
Right.
So that, technically, we've already had a female Doctor before and a Black Doctor before, so... people shouldn't be upset about it. Well, they're upset about it anyway.
I have a theory that people just need something to be upset about.
They do. And something like Doctor, I mean, we talk about change.
Right.
Something like Doctor Who, people always hate the new Doctor.
That is actually true.
And then after about 2 years, it's their new favorite Doctor.
That's true.
I remember watching when Chris Eccleston regenerated into David Tennant, and the person I was watching it with said, "Oh, I'm not going to watch this again now. He's all goofy." And then David Tennant became her favorite Doctor.
Right. And everyone else's.
I'm still a Patrick Troughton fan, so yeah, I go old school.
Well, you were indoctrinated from a very young age.
The word is absolutely perfect for it, isn't it?
isn't that like a requirement of being born British? Like in the nursery, they're playing Doctor Who for you kids.
Well, it's funny because I answered something on Twitter the other day. Obviously, I follow some Doctor Who stuff. And somebody asked, you know, who was your first Doctor? Who was your favorite Doctor? Who was your first companion? Who was your favorite companion? And the first Doctor Who episode I remember, I just remember one scene from it as a child, and it was a John Pertwee episode which aired in 1974.
Wow.
Before I was three. So I was like 2.5 years old, but I remember this one scene from it, and I was rewatching the back catalogue and that scene came on. I'm like, oh, I remember this. I don't know if it replayed, but they didn't tend to replay it in the UK too much. So I must have, at about the age of 2.5, been watching that with my mum, who was a Doctor Who fan. Mm. And yeah, that stuck in my head. So John Pertwee was the first one I watched.
Wow.
But obviously I grew up during the Tom Baker era.
Of course, yeah.
The golden age.
Yes, the golden age, yes. That's right.
Yeah.
All right, well, Rachel, thank you so much for taking time. You were quite generous with your time this afternoon, and I have had such a lovely conversation with you, and I hope you'll come back and talk some more. But you should know, you're just a pleasure. You're a pleasure to know, and I'm grateful for your online friendship. And I do think we should take a trip sometime. Maybe I'll come with you to the next Micronation conference, because I'm down to be in a Micronation, or two, or three.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, it is, I believe they're looking to hold it the weekend of July 4th, so they can have some fireworks go on around them in Joliet, Illinois. So they've announced it's going to be there, and you know, the details to follow.
I really like that all these Micronations are like, "Fuck your Independence Day." We don't observe your Independence Day.
Oh no, they're quite, you know, we're quite happy to have the fireworks going on around us. So yeah,
awesome.
It's to celebrate MicroCon, and I believe there is also a Euro MicroCon that's going to be happening in, I believe, in Ypres in Belgium.
Ooh, well, that would be fun.
So I believe I believe that's next year, but I don't have the exact details on that.
All right. Well, we're going to touch base on that, I promise. Thanks again, and do come back.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. I've had a lovely time.